HPPodCraft.com.
Fate plays strange tricks on one, doesn't it? 6 months ago, I was a well-known and moderately successful practicing psychiatrist. Today, I am an inmate of a sanatorium for mental cases. In my capacity of alienist and physician, I have often committed patients to the selfsame institution in which I myself am now confined. And today, irony of ironies, I find myself their brother in misfortune. And yet I'm not really mad. They sent me here because I chose to tell the truth, and it was not the kind of truth men dare to reveal or recognize. Of course, I really have no substantial proof to offer. I have never seen Professor Chopin since that eventful night last August, and my subsequent investigations failed to substantiate his claim to a post at Newberry College. This, however, only testifies to the validity of my statement, a statement which sent me to shameful confinement, to a living death which I abhor.
Right out of the Lovecraft Handbook, ladies and gents, if you want a short story that's sure to beguile them, start your main character in the asylum.
Hey, yeah. You know, that was the opening of Robert Bloch's The Grinning Ghoul.
Was.
Robert Bloch, he was a loved protege of H.P. Lovecraft, and that is why we're going to be talking about him here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
You can find us on your internet dial at hppodcraft.com. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. And that reader is again our beloved Andrew Lehman, who is with us all month as we talk about Robert Bloch stories with a Lovecraftian twist in a month we love to call Blocktober.
Not to be confused with New Kids on the Blocktober.
What?
Yeah, I guess they have a song called Suicide in the Study.
What?
That was at the topic of another podcast, so it's been causing all sorts of confusion between the different fans. I'm just kidding. That'd be awesome if New Kids on the Block had a song called Suicide in the Study. Before we get into today's story, The Grinning Ghoul,
yes,
I just wanted to read this newspaper article that I found online.
Okay.
It's about our author. It's from the Milwaukee Journal Green Sheet, April 6th, 1935. I read it and I just think it's kind of adorable because it's about him when he was a teenage writer. It says, Milwaukee youth writes horror tales, sells them. That's the headline. Started at 16, saves to become comedian, also draws and molds statues. I didn't really know that about him.
No, I knew about the comedian, but I didn't know about the statues.
The idea for that story, it starts in a weird way, the article, but the idea for that story was conceived on a fog-ridden night in June, the night the streetcars were called in because of the electric company strikes. The fog on that night, Bloch reminds you, was so thick that it was impossible to see a foot ahead of you. For some reason, I wanted to do something unusual that night, and the weirdest thing I could think of was to spend the night in a cemetery. So I walked from my home on East Knapp Street to Soldiers' Home Cemetery and spent the night sitting on a tombstone staring into the fog. Do you think he really did that?
No.
Is he just playing it up for the papers?
He's playing it up for the papers. He must be.
Occasionally the wind would shift the heavy mist and then I would see the gravestones quite clearly. And to me they looked like the fingernails of a corpse. I wouldn't let myself get frightened and I kept reminding myself that I had deliberately undertaken an experiment to discover how I would react to such a situation. So Bloch's a little gothy, I think.
Yeah, I guess so.
At that age. The next subheading in the article says, The Grinning Ghoul, which is our story today.
Yeah.
As he sat there, fragments of ghost stories flitted through his mind. Gradually, vague ideas began to take shape. He created characters, a plot. He outlined the details of his story as he walked home in the early dawn. Once in the house, he sat down immediately and in longhand wrote The Secret of the Tomb, a yarn dealing with ghouls. I wonder if the newspaper readers would know. I mean, I guess ghoul is kind of a generic for all sorts of monsters.
Well, yeah, monsters that eat dead people.
Has it always meant monsters that eat dead people?
A ghoul is a monster, this is according to Wikipedia, a ghoul is a monster or evil spirit in Arabic mythology associated with graveyards and the consuming of human flesh.
Okay, so it always has been that way.
The term was first used in English literature in 1786 in William Beckford's Orientalist novel, Vathek.
I'm glad you cleared that up for me. So going on with the article, among the stories purchased during the last few weeks is The Grinning Ghoul. Bloch has been asked to illustrate this tale, for this young man can use his pencil with equal ease for writing or drawing his grotesqueries. I looked up some of Robert Bloch's art. It's pretty good. Important as terror tales are to him, Robert views them only as an interlude to help him realize his ambitions to be a comedian. He has wanted to be a comedian as long back as he can remember, and meanwhile, scarcely a day goes by that he does not write 4 or 5 gags and tuck them away in a drawer for the time he will be able to use them. He wants to act in sketches that he writes. To Robert, there is nothing strange about being interested at the same time in horror and humor. There is such a slight line of differentiation between what is ludicrous that I think they come from the same thought patterns, he explains. As an example, the grotesque masks worn in Mardi Gras parades are ludicrous and horrible at the same time. I thought that was cool. And we've actually talked about that on the show plenty of times.
We have, yeah.
The ties between humor and horror. I think it is wise to work on several stories at one time, at least two or three, says the young man gravely. Jumping from one to the other is recreation if you write constantly, and at the same time it helps to develop a uniform style. That is good advice. He also sculpted in his living room. He's got a statue of a huge ape and a grinning skull, both of which he sculpted himself. Then the last thing, I thought this was a little bit of a downer to end this article about the plucky teen with, but it says afraid of death. Robert is a voracious reader and has read every type of horror story imaginable. This unusual young man who can write impersonally and rationally of demons, who can calmly spend a night in a graveyard, who, with words, can conjure up frightful scenes, and who can talk with astonishing maturity of literature and economic and social trends. This same young man confesses to an inexplicable, profound fear of death. I can write horror tales very impersonally, but I can't view death impersonally, he said. The more I read of it, the more I fear it. I guess it is my imagination, but right now there doesn't seem to be much I can do about it.
Wow.
And that's the end of the article. On to this week's story. What did you think of the grinning ghoul?
I strapped on my hip boots, a rough woolen jacket, miner's cap with a candle on the brim, and I descended into this malignant tale with more than a bit of optimism. But I was a bit disappointed by this one.
Yeah.
Maybe I had too high of expectations because I was thinking, block, cool story, awesome. But, well, let's talk about it. And
let's talk about it. I didn't think it was bad, but definitely a little disappointing.
Yeah. Story starts off with this psychiatrist who's in a mental institution. He's seen something that has really messed him up, and it has something to do with this client of his, Professor Chopin. Supposedly, this Chopin claimed to be a professor at Newberry College, but the doc can't really substantiate that.
Right, and the doctor says he could prove that what he's seen, the horrible, horrible thing that landed him in the asylum, he can prove that it's real, but to do that, he'd have to take people to a certain cemetery and show them certain something that's beneath this certain tomb.
Certainly. He does not want
Certainly
to do that.
He does not want to do that.
The doc also says that he hasn't told anyone of the actual real location of the cemetery because this tomb is horrible and he is trying to protect mankind from finding out this horrible truth.
But he's going
to
go ahead and write it all down. It's just a bit of stress relief, I guess. So
part of his therapy.
He says this all started because he had a patient on a hot August morning, that patient being Professor Chopin. And when he meets Professor Chopin, he thinks he might be from another country because he has a strange intonation and a certain sibilant way of talking.
The Chopin guy was also kind of weird looking. He said he was tall and thin. He looked like he was a man in his 40s. He had some kind of creepy eyes, but they were very pale, a big protruding forehead, long jet black brows. His nose was large, with sensual nostrils, but he had thin lips. He had long, tapering fingers that terminated in lengthy nails. He also had wrinkles on his face and some kind of weird skin condition that he wasn't quite sure what that was all about.
Yeah, there's something just weird about him.
Something weird. He had muddy shoes and a formal suit that was a little strange to be wearing that day that was kind of too big for him.
Yeah.
And he also didn't wear a hat, which was totally inappropriate.
But this psychiatrist goes a little overboard with his quick armchair diagnosis. He says, obviously, he was an eccentric type. A schizophrenic, perhaps? Tendencies toward hypochondria? Whoa, because his suit's too big? Yeah. And he's got muddy shoes?
That makes sense to me.
Kind of a snap judgment. I would hate, I mean, the stuff I'm wearing when I pour out of this house sometimes. Yep, that guy's clearly schizophrenic.
Well, yeah. He's
wearing black socks and sandals.
Well, and you've got that tube top on.
And the tube top on, yeah. And the bat wings.
The doc started to ask him some typical questions that you would ask a new client, but Chopin cut him off and said, look, I ain't got time to dally, so, you know, let's get on with this. Chopin said he'd been having bad dreams that were freaking him out, caused him to be really bummed all day. He can't work, can't do anything but binge watch Deep Space Nine on Netflix.
Ooh, that's low.
So Doc asked him, which I've been doing, by the way. That's why.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you okay, Chris?
Yeah, no, I'm fine. Actually, I'm really enjoying Deep Space Nine. So,
okay.
You know, for him, that's...
It's not a depressive...
No. It's really enjoyable. So the Doc asks him to tell him about his dreams. So the dream, the one that freaks him out the most, is about this ancient cemetery. And there's a very old part of it, very overgrown, super creepy. And in this dream, he half hears voices urging him deeper into this cemetery. His dream takes him to a tomb.
Get in here.
It takes him to a tomb. And there are chains on the door. He takes off the chains. He goes inside. Once inside, he gets down in there. There's a switch that he flips open to reveal a secret door that leads down a passageway, then down some stairs. It's hot and humid. It smells of rotting things. He's not bothered, though, by that. He's drawn by that smell.
This is just like Secret of the Tomb, or Secret in the Tomb.
Yeah.
That you have to go to the creepy cemetery, go down underneath the tomb. That's where the ghouls are. But I also get it. I was obsessed with those places, too. You know, when I was younger. Mm-hmm. What would it be like if you could go into that thing? You know, when you'd go by a graveyard.
Yeah. When he's down there, there's a series of tunnels going every which way, and he wanders around a bit and then sees something nasty.
The horror always came next. He would suddenly emerge into a series of dimly lighted chambers, and as he stood undetected in the shadows, he would see things. These were the dwellers that laired beneath, the ghastly spawn that ravened on the dead. They dwelt in nighted caverns lined with human bones and adored the primal gods before altars shaped of skulls. They had tunnels leading to the graves and burrows still farther below in which they stalked a living prey. These were the grisly night gaunts that he beheld in dreams. These were ghouls.
It must have been nice. I mean, this story came out, Weird Tales, June 1936. Mm-hmm. Pickman's model was about 10 years old at this point, and yeah. We're also approaching Lovecraft's death around that time. Must have been nice for him to see people using his stuff.
Yeah. So these ghouls that he sees, they're doing some messed up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It says they continue to indulge in eldritch feasting in the charnel chambers or join in orgies without name.
Yeah.
So these ghouls are part of the lifestyle?
They sure are.
Just with cannibalism?
Yeah.
Which, you know, actually, that's just kind of judgy of me on my part. I just realized that because they're not actually cannibals because they're not eating ghouls.
No.
Because you would have to be eating ghouls to be a cannibal. They're not humans.
Right.
So just because you eat a person doesn't make you a cannibal. When a shark eats a dude, you don't call him a cannibal.
Well, perhaps.
What do you mean, perhaps? Have you ever heard anybody ever call a shark a cannibal?
If the shark used to be a human. You know, like if he's a were-shark. Because, this guy, Pickman was turning into a ghoul, right? Like,
right,
I assume
sure.
A lot of these ghouls. Are all ghouls ex-humans?
I don't know.
Well, if you used to be a human and then you change into something else, but then you eat up on a human, is it cannibalism or not?
That is a question for the ages.
For the ages.
Just because there is some debate, I'm not going to say it was a cannibal orgy. It's a human eating orgy.
Block does not seem shy about bringing sex into his stories, though.
No.
He hints, or at least he hints at it much more overtly than Lovecraft would.
Yeah.
Even here writing as a teenager.
So, of course, Chompin thinks that these visions might actually be happening. And the doc says, why do you think these would be happening? He goes, I don't know. But he goes, well, what are you studying? And he goes, oh, I read scary books.
Yeah. So what do you do for a living then? Oh, I read a ton of scary books about underground caverns and ghouls.
And, you know, we get the litany of scary books, you know, the Ludwig Rites. Prince, Mysteries of the Worm, the Black Rites, Necronomicon, and of course, Cultus de Ghouls.
And the doctor, the psychiatrist, he also seems familiar with these scary books as his patient lists them off. He says, surely I, as an enlightened and educated man, must admit the veiled and subtle truths so furtively revealed in such tomes. So somehow, it's that Lovecraft world where everybody's read the Necronomicon.
Yeah.
They say it's so forbidden and forgotten, and yet everybody's read the Necronomicon.
Everybody seemed to have read it.
Everybody seems to have read all of these scary things. I'm thinking, liberal arts education used to be a lot different than it is now.
Sure did, yeah.
When we wanted a safe space in my college days, it wasn't because somebody used the wrong pronoun. It was because somebody conjured a fucking monster. I had a one-night stand with a swamp witch. Who can say that these days?
Well, wait a minute. So it's not that dangerous if she's like looking to hook up and not just kill everybody.
It didn't turn out well. That's this character, I guess, who's angry at kids these days because he had to study the Necronomicon when he was a kid. This was that character that responded to you. The swamp witch, it didn't turn out well.
So wait, character, did you in class summon up a swamp witch and then instead of her killing everybody in the classroom?
I'd never had an amaretto stone sour before. It was college. It was an abhorrent eldritch walk of shame.
Oh, golly. So, doctor says, hey, look, there's your problem. Scary books equals scary dreams.
Of course, you're reading these all day, and then you're going to have dreams all night about them.
So just calm down. Chopin gives him this hard look and says, look, I didn't tell you everything. He decided to actually, you know, I'm lightheaded from laughing right now. he decided to actually go to the cemetery to see if his dream told him the truth. He went out to the tomb, and then he opened the door, he found the hidden lever, went down the stairs and the tunnels, but the next thing he knew, he was back in his home and in bed.
Which sounds like a dream to me.
Yeah, I know. But the doc here, he decides that the only way to get him out of this delusion is to indulge him and go to the cemetery with Chopin. Mm-hmm. So I talked to my wife, Rachel, about this. She's a licensed psychotherapist. And she said that this is the actual prescribed technique, specifically when people have delusions of subterranean human eating group sex. This is what you do.
Interesting. How many of those cases is she currently treating?
Zero.
Oh, that's what you have to say because of confidentiality, right?
Yeah, of course.
Wow. But that's what you do in the...
That is exactly what you do. Yeah. If somebody says that, then you, out of work with your client...
Let's go to the tomb.
You go to the tomb at 10 o'clock at night. I asked her in all seriousness, and she laughed real hard. That was the that was her response. So Chopin is totally up for this. He thinks this sounds totally cool and is going to fix his problem for him. So they plan to get together the following night at the cemetery.
And this isn't really a terrible setup, actually. I like the idea. Like, I've been having these dreams. They're making my life difficult. Maybe the psychiatrist would say kind of like how you overcome a phobia, right?
Confront it.
Okay, let's confront it. Let's go there at night, all the same way that you have it in the dream, so I can show you that it's not real. And that's kind of a cool setup for a story.
Right. Strangely, the doc reads up on the cults de ghouls before they go, because he just has it, I guess.
Well, exactly. He's got it on his Kindle.
Yeah, not only has he read it, he just happens to have a copy. So that night, he shows up all decked out for some tomb exploring. And he waits while Chopin's supposed to be showing up because he's not there right on time. And he gets a bit scared. But eventually Chopin shows up and he's all decked out too. And then they go into the cemetery.
He couldn't repress an involuntary shudder as his mind dwelt unbidden upon the fearful trafficking of the worms below in that cemetery. He didn't care to let his thoughts rest upon the grave earth or the diabolic density of the encircling shadows. So the atmosphere is already getting to the psychiatrist. Not as cold and clinical as he wants to be.
So Chopin leads him straight to the tomb that he's just described. They go in, chains on the door, they go in the door, they go to the switch, there's a secret door. Again, it's all happening, it's happening.
Yeah, and he hesitates. Oh, wow, I didn't think it would match the dream this well.
But Doc is like, well, you know, this part is true.
Yeah.
But the other stuff may be made up. Maybe there are people that actually live down here. Or... maybe there's some like homeless refugees or something like that. If that's the case, they might need help.
I mean, if all of this is coming true, okay, maybe this dream is based on something, but certainly it can't be supernatural ghoul creatures.
No.
But so there might actually be, but he thinks maybe there are actual
homeless
cannibal people living down here.
That, well, that's what I was thinking. What if there were cannibals living down there? Like people that are into eating people, not supernatural ghouls, just humans.
Well, this story doesn't really refute that. I mean, we can say there's no proof that that's not what it was or what he perceived. It was
right.
Actually,
yeah.
Just that. You know what I mean?
You were talking about this earlier, but Alan Moore, he has written a bunch of Lovecraftian stuff. Like he wrote Neonomicon and the New Providence series. And he's said before that he feels that there's a bunch of sex in the subtext of Lovecraft. When Lovecraft is talking about unspeakable acts, they are usually sex is what he's talking about. I remember specifically in Call of Cthulhu when there was the ritual in the swamp, and he says they were performing unspeakable acts, as in they were probably having sex. But for Lovecraft, being this really uptight New Englander guy and totally repressed, for him that was something that was horrible. Now, in Alan Moore's stuff, he's got a lot of rape in there, which I'm not sure that was intended. In Lovecraft's writing, I think they maybe were having sex, but just the whole idea that they were having consensual group sex in front of monsters, well, you know, which is pretty horrible. I don't think I would be comfortable in that circumstance.
Wait, as one of the cultists having sex or observing it?
Any of it, really. I think I would be pretty uncomfortable.
Well, I'd be totally comfortable if I was just...
But Alan Moore thinks that it was more rapey. Like that was the unspeakable acts and stuff. Would it be more horrible if at these monster cults, they were raping one another or if they were having consensual sex with one another?
Oh, gosh.
I don't feel comfortable with rape in my horror stories.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's too real or if it's just that Because murder, I'm not into murder. I hate murder. I don't want anybody to be murdered. I don't want to be murdered. But when I see it in a film or read in a story, I am titillated by it, but not rape. Rape is horrible. Like, I don't even want it in my horror. So why is murder okay in horror and rape isn't?
I don't know if murder is okay. I mean, I think that murder as a device is a lot cleaner and clearer. Somebody is alive and then they're not. But I don't think there's anything off limits in fiction at all. If you want to use those, I mean, murder and rape certainly happen.
Sure.
No, I think when people get upset about it being used in fiction, it's because there's a casualness of its use.
Yes.
Much of the time by male authors. And there's also a power dynamic with rape that gets used in a lot of male fantasy fiction. And I think that that drives a lot of stories and it's something that people are upset about.
Right.
That in a lot of action, it's the antagonist, the bad guy's about to rape the hero's love interest. And then the hero steps in to save her. And then she bestows her affection on him in the end. Well, that's really about transferring possession of a woman, isn't it? You know, the guy tried to dominate her and then the other alpha male stepped in and took over. I think if sexual violence is being used in fiction, horror is its natural home.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's like sex and rape and those things are implied in Lovecraft. And I disagree with the notion that Lovecraft didn't include sex in his fiction because he was unable to deal with it. That's putting intent on something. It's something we can't know. I mean, I don't
know.
He chose not to describe many things in his fiction, and he did that for effect. I don't think that it denotes repression. I think when he says something's unspeakable, you think of it as rape. Another person thinks of it as consensual sex in front of a monster. A third person doesn't think of sex at all, but some other horrific thing. And that's the reason that he treats his fiction that way.
Yeah.
It's all about what you want to show. And I think for Alan Moore, he's actually interested in showing brutality.
Yeah.
I actually haven't read his... I read The Courtyard, but I didn't read any of the other stuff. I know that there's some deep one rape in there.
It gets super rapey.
But I did read, you know, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and I think, you know, when Mr. Hyde rapes the Invisible Man in that comic book, it's something that he is interested in showcasing. You know, I'm not interested in horror films that depict realistic torture violence. Some people are, I'm not.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not as interested in brutality of that nature. So I think that I'm not as apt to read something by Alan Moore that's going to go there. But I think that Lovecraft is a little like a genre, you know, and it's a lot like the Western, for example. Mm-hmm. There are certain tropes that are going to fit into a Lovecraft story. And then after that, you kind of can do whatever you do. So some people are going to be graphic. Some people are going to be restrained. Some people are going to focus on relationships. Some people are going to focus on atmosphere.
Sure.
So you're not going to necessarily like something just because the tropes are there.
Right.
And I'm sure that you get all kinds of, you know, hey, check out this thing. It's so Lovecraftian. And you go, yeah, but I don't like that kind of story.
Of course.
You
know? Yeah.
Anyway, I think maybe I'm going off what your initial question.
No, I was doing some rereading of A Shadow Over Innsmouth. I did in my head have it that the Deep Ones raped people.
I think they do.
But there's a whole issue of Zadok Allen. He says there's the first oath and the second oath and then the third oath.
Right.
And the third oath is when you basically agree to have sex with a Deep One.
Right.
If you're agreeing to have sex with a Deep One, then that's not rape.
Sure. But I mean, I think it probably both happen.
That's not in the text.
I think it's implied. I mean, I came away from that story with thinking that, but you know, you don't really know, which I think is the charm of that story.
Right.
I understand why people get obsessed with it, but I'm like equally as interested in who's the tailor in this town who is keeping everybody's clothes together while they're turning into fish people.
Right.
Because they have a whole... And who organized that parade that they have at the end of the thing? Like, is it some Leslie Knope kind of go-getter Deep One that's always trying to get everybody to assemble and... You know, those things are equally as interesting to me. So
absolutely.
I mean, you know,
Whatever
is happening down here does involve sex. Robert Bloch kind of suggested that earlier in the story.
He definitely said orgy.
Right. Although an orgy could just be it's an orgy of gluttony. You know, orgy doesn't necessarily have to be sex.
They're both down in the tunnels. Chompin is saying some crazy stuff. He goes, let me show you the truth, he said. I can no longer doubt it. What's strange about this is the doc seems to be getting a little cold feet, but Chompin threatens to go to the police with this stuff. And of course, the doc doesn't want his good name being tied up with cannibal, homeless, lifestyle enthusiasts.
Yeah, he's like, wait a minute, we're down here now. If you go to the police, people are going to find out I was down here with you.
Yeah.
And my whole like, oh, this is a treatment. This is not going to fly.
No, it's not gonna work.
So they go in through the down into the tunnel. The opening gaped like the mouth of a mythic monster.
And they finally go down the stairs and into the tunnel system.
Yeah, and there's all of these fat rats swarming around everywhere. Well fed, he thinks, probably on dead bodies.
Right.
Just pretty crazy. And then he's also thinking, why does Chopin know the way so well? I get that he dreamt about this, but he really clearly has been down here before.
As they go down the steps, Doc notices that there is no dust on the stairs at all. They're in constant use.
Dun, dun, dun.
They go down deeper until they get to the cave with this bluish light, phosphorescent, but with no obvious source. They hear some sounds, and Chopin tells the Doc just to keep quiet.
It's really crazy. It says he would prove now that his words were true. I must wait here while he ventured into the black beyond.
Yeah, well, they sit quietly, listening, and then Chopin just takes off for the tunnels, and he's like, whoa, wait, and then he just waits there because he's not sure what he's supposed to do.
Right, he just takes off. Bye, see ya.
And so the Doc's just sitting there in the dark. It's super quiet. Like, he doesn't hear anything, and it's very scary, and then all of a sudden there's this scream. It says, a sudden crescendo of indescribable madness welled upon the entombed air, and my soul cleaved, for I knew what that cry meant. At this point, he knows everything Chopin was saying was totally true.
Yeah, and I wonder if he thinks the cry, does he Chopin screaming, like, oh no, the ghouls are getting him, or it's he can hear the screaming of the ghouls.
Yeah, that's, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if he was implying that it was the ghouls that screamed, or Chopin screamed and then Chopin was being killed, or maybe somebody else was being killed.
Well, I assumed it was Chopin being killed, but right. Then you find out later that might not be the case.
Yeah.
But one thing he definitely hears after that is the clamor of feet and paws.
Yes.
Coming up towards him.
Moving through the darkness, and he just bolts at that point. He's out of there. He gets to the top. The monsters are on his tail. He slams the tomb closed. But just as he does, he sees something before his candle cap goes out. Something horrible?
I shall never forget that night, whatever I do to erase those hideous memories. Never shall I find the sleep I crave. I dare not even kill myself for fear of being buried instead of cremated, though death would be welcome to such as I have become. I shall never forget, for now I know the whole truth of the affair. But there is one memory I would give my soul to blot forever from my brain. That mad moment when I saw the monsters in the torchlight, the horrors from below. For the first and foremost of them all was the monster known to men as Professor Chopin.
That's the horrible ending. And I mean horrible isn't scary. Not
yeah.
Kind of a good ending, I guess.
Now, I'm confused about this story, though. Was Chopin a ghoul the whole time and then was just trying to get him down there to eat him?
I think my interpretation of the story is that it's like the Secret of the Tomb, where it's ghoul baiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, except last week that guy just created a whole family legend so he could get the occasional generational snack. Here,
mm-hmm.
It might be he's like kind of getting jumped into the gang, you know what I mean? So, because it says he's got this weird dermatological condition.
Yeah.
Body is fitting in his suit weird. So I think he's turning into a ghoul, but maybe you have to bring them food. So he's luring people down there. It's maybe he's going to a bunch of different psychiatrists and he's saying the same thing. They're all going down there with him.
So yeah, you think that the whole thing was a setup just to bring the guy down there to eat him?
Absolutely.
That's what I thought too.
What else would it be?
Well, that he was somehow being affected by these things in his dreams, like he was saying. Somehow they were contacting him or beckoning him to come down. And as he went down there, he actually physically went down there. Like you said, he was turning into a ghoul. And that scream maybe was the moment that he became a ghoul, or he turned, or something like that.
Right.
That he was as much a victim of the process as the professor.
Yeah, I hear you. That's possible too. Or there's a third option where he was actually just running away from them and the professor got it all wrong. He turned around and just slammed the door on this poor guy. He's one of the ghouls too. What?
No, wait a minute.
Why would you think that? How? They're eating my femur. How do you think you would lure people down into the tunnels if you were becoming a ghoul?
Oh, that's easy. There's a bunch of puppies and swimsuit models down there. I already tried that one.
I thought I was hearing it as you were saying it, so I thought you were saying, hey, there's a bunch of puppies in swimsuits down here.
That's good too.
Which actually is a little like what our story next week is going to be about, the brood of Bubastis.
I'm really curious now and excited to check out the brood of Bubastis.
Yeah.
But before we do, I'd love to thank our delightful and endearing reader, Andrew Lehman.
Thanks, Andrew. Always glad to have you.
And that is our second episode for Blocktober. I'm looking forward to next week's The Brood of Bubastis, and I am Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.